Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. For right now, we're going to dive into our bacteria are the root of all evil, or maybe at least the root of all inflammation. So the lifestyle diseases, right? That's heart disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancers. And now that we seem to have the bacteria on the run with our antibiotics, it's your fault. It's all your fault. You eat too much red meat. You don't eat enough fruit and veggies. You drink. You're fat. You don't exercise. And, you know, we're focusing on trying to get people to do those things. And yes, indeed, we do see health benefits. But a lot of these things that show up later in life are all linked to inflammation. And the problem is what we have is correlation. In other words, two things tend to go together, inflammation and diabetes, for example. What we don't necessarily have down clearly is the directionality of that. Does A cause B, or does B cause A, or does C cause A and B, but C is invisible? Well, it may be the third of these possibilities. You'll be aware that ulcers are, in the modern frame of reference, caused by bacteria a lot of the time, or by nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. We used to think ulcers were caused by stress. But in fact, stress causes problems with the vagus nerve and with normal function, and it opens up a niche for invasion by a bacteria called H. pylori, which once it gets its little corkscrew tail down into the stomach, causes irritation and causes the stomach to produce ulcers. And Helicobacter pylori just is fine. Helicobacter pylori is just fine in an acid bath. Likes a good acid bath. It's a bracing for it, unlike other bacteria which wither and cry, I'm melting. So the issue really is that what we see, what we can see, determines what hypotheses we can make about what it might be. And in this case, maybe we've been wrong. I'm talking about gum disease, and we'll get to, and in particular, a bacterium called Porphyromonas gingivalis. This is a bacteria that is located, well, we thought it was located in the little pockets on your gums, you know, when you go to the hygienist and they shout out the 3, 2, 2, 4, 5, 5. Those are the situations where you're going to see a circumstance of inflammation in the gum. But this particular bacteria, Porphyromonas gingivalis, we're going to call it PG for the rest of this commentary, creates a enzyme called gingipain, and it's a protein digesting enzyme. Now, it actually is a pretty funny bug, just like the H. pylori likes acid. Most bacteria don't like inflammation. It likes inflammation. It finds it bracing. It actually perpetuates inflammation by producing some molecules that specifically manipulate the human inflammatory process. It turns it down but not off, and this simmering inflammation doesn't kill PG, but it does kill your own cells. These dead cells that slough off actually provide food for P. gingivalis, which needs to eat protein, unlike most bacteria, which get by just fine on glucose alone. So when you destroy those human cells in the gum pocket, you also release iron, which is a major nutrient for bacteria. So it's as if the bacteria is unlocking the growth nutrients it needs in iron and eating the debris that it creates with its enzymes. It's a very sophisticated bug. So eventually, if you have an inflamed tooth, You build off, you lose the tooth, but there's a long period of time where people just have these sort of smoldering gum infections. And, oh gosh, it must be 5 years ago now. I remember it talking on the program about the correlation between Alzheimer's disease and stroke and gum disease. And the thinking was that that the inflammation got into the blood vessels of the brain and also contributed to whatever it is that triggers the formation of the amyloid beta plaques. It turns out that P. gingivalis is a real strong candidate to do a lot more than just Alzheimer's and stroke, as if you should put the word just in front of these very, very devastating diseases. Once P. gingivalis actually gets into the bloodstream, so perhaps during a tooth cleaning or what they call a deep cleaning, it'll actually hitch a ride inside white blood cells, and it can enter the endothelial cells. Those are the cells lining the arteries. And essentially, it just sits there sending out immune signals, and this probably contributes to the development of plaque. We've found P. gingivalis in inflamed tissue in the brain, the aorta, the heart, the liver, the spleen, the kidneys, joints, and the pancreas. And it's possible that it may even be a contributing factor in diabetes. So back in January, teams at Eight University and a San Francisco biotech enzyme called Cortexim found this gingipain, the enzyme made only by this particular bacteria, in 99% of brain samples from people who died with Alzheimer's. They also found it in the spinal fluid. They found it in, they took mice that were Alzheimer's prone and gave them the bacteria, and they started developing Alzheimer's symptoms. They blocked the gingipain with an experimental drug, and they reversed the proto-Alzheimer's in these rat models or mouse models. This is pretty exciting. They also found that there was some gingipain in people who didn't have Alzheimer's, but the thought is that this is a cumulative process. Interestingly enough, this ties in with APOE4, which is the gene that is associated with Alzheimer's. Last year, a Swedish company discovered, Swedish researchers, these were scientists, discovered that the gingipains are better at destroying that particular form of APOB than its other forms. So people who have that APOE4 may be the people who are more vulnerable to the gum disease, which certainly makes sense. They found it, as I said, in atherosclerotic plaque. And one of the researchers, a Dr. Jenko, and another researcher at, the University of Florida, I'm probably going to mangle this, Lashmaya Kesavalu, cultured viable P. gingivalis bacteria from the atherosclerotic aortas of mice. This is starting to look very much like what we need to prove that the bacteria is causing the plaque, just as it took a while to prove that the bacteria was causing the ulcers. Even conservative organizations like the American Heart Association think gum disease is a risk for cardiovascular disease. But again, it may be that gum disease actually causes it, not just the general inflammation, but specific compounds produced by a specific bacteria. And that gingivain, well, guess what? They're working on a vaccine for that, and wouldn't that be interesting to see? Turns out, gingivain also goes to the pancreas, creating a possibility, and it's found in the pancreas of people that become diabetic. So maybe some of the type 2 diabetes that we're seeing particularly is actually being aggravated or even triggered by the gene products of this bacteria. So if you give this to mice, you increase their risk of diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, fatty liver disease, and Alzheimer's. People who drink more alcohol tend to have more gum disease and tend to have more P. gingivalis. It's also been associated with Parkinson's disease, and kidney disease, and cancers of the mouth, esophagus, stomach, and pancreas. Believe it or not, if you inject the bacteria into the retina, you get age-related macular degeneration in experimental studies, and it's been linked to an increased risk of premature birth. So, what's the moral here? Well, until we know more, the real moral is floss. Take good care of your teeth. If they tell you you've got a pocket and you need to do something, well, do it. Also, I want to point out that there is one kryptonite against PG that we can all use, and that, my friends, is oxygen. This is an anaerobic bacteria. That's why it likes that deep pocket down there. There's no oxygen in that location. It's also why it took us so long to figure it out. It's difficult to culture anaerobes. They tend to grow slowly, and they're hard to detect and hard to grow. So we often misattribute the infection to something else that's oxygen tolerant and grows faster. And this has been a head scratcher since we started growing bacteria in petri dishes. This is also one of the reasons why you can't really get a good probiotic that matches what's actually in a healthy gut. I'm looking forward to that vaccine. I think that's a great idea. In the meantime, how do you get the oxygen? Good old hydrogen peroxide. Or, if you got a lot of money, you can go to one of the ozone therapy people and have ozone sprayed into your gum pockets. But just getting some hydrogen peroxide down there, and you can use a soft catheter and just a little plain peroxide and just kind of squirt it in to the area where you have the pocket, and that oxygen tension will kill and reduce the bacteria. You dip your floss in, or your little pocket brush in, peroxide before you put it in your mouth. These are effective measures to reduce this bacteria, and who knows, in a couple of years, if we get a further proof of concept, we may be telling you here on this program that this is your key to preventing Alzheimer's. Let's pop into our first email. Now, this email came to me via askdrdawn.com, where you can also go and pop in an email. But if you want to get your answer tonight, use onair@ksqd.org. This from Harry in Santa Cruz. Dear Dr. Dawn, my 58-year-old sweetie has restless leg syndrome, which greatly affects our sleep, in that she kicks and jerks in her sleep, and as she is falling asleep, the bouts last on average from half an hour to an hour, and come in cycles of every 12 seconds. Yikes. Needless to say, this keeps me from getting a good night's sleep and keeps her up at times. She has tried magnesium, yoga, meditation, Ayurvedic oils, elevating her legs before bed. She doesn't kick if she's sleeping on the ground, but does kick if she sits for a long time, such as in a movie or in a car. She uses a CPAP for snoring and apnea, which has helped with sleeping with her, but the kicking is very disturbing to both of us. Please help if you can recommend anything. Well, there's a couple of things to look at here, Harry. First of all, make sure that she's had a ferritin test. And this is an iron storage protein. And if ferritin levels are low, then taking iron can sometimes be beneficial for the restless leg syndrome. Not sure what the rationale for that is or how they figured it out, but sometimes when you're searching around, you just fix everything you find, and it's like, oh, that made it better. I don't know why it made it better, but I'm not arguing with it. Another thing is, if your sweetie has ever had a 23andMe, you can run that through either Promethease or Genetic Genie and find out whether she has mutations in COMT, MTHFR, or MTRR. These mutations affect the production and balance of dopamine, which has been linked in many studies to the restless leg syndrome. It's almost kind of a movement disorder, and it's as you fall asleep and that it's allowed to rear its ugly head. I've recently heard anecdotal stories, and there was a small scientific study looking at CBD and THC for restless legs. So that's something relatively new. A patient of mine is taking a very high-strength THCA tincture, which she tells me is THCA, which is the non-psychoactive form of THC. It is the carboxylic acid, to get chemical on you. And what that means is it isn't using combustion or heat to turn the THCA into THC, the anandamide that we're all familiar with. Instead, it still has a chemical group on it that prevents it from being psychoactive. So I'm not sure if what she's using isn't what it says on the label, or whether it is that, but it's at such a high concentration that a little THC sneaks in for the ride, or indeed whether or not it was the residual THCA in the products that the other people were using in the scientific study, which is the isolated study that I was could find on a Google search linking THCA, THC and CBD with RLS. The data on CBD alone for RLS is not very good. There are many people who it doesn't work for, a few who said it did. I kind of inclined to think that the ones it worked for simply slept through their jerking. And of course, our friend here, Sweetie, has Harry as a witness, so he'd be the one to be able to say if it helps. If she did have a COMT mutation, then we might want to use a different approach, which would be to help with methylation. And that's a topic that's beyond the scope of my response to your email. But if you've got that 23andMe data, you can certainly shoot me an email, and I will walk through in a private reply what you need to do to get to the next step in your analysis. Now, this is a handy little thing. Researchers have been playing around with trying to chemically separate sperm that have an X chromosome from sperm that have a Y chromosome. And wouldn't that be handy? Normally, sperm come in about a 50-50 ratio of male to female. This is a study done in mice, but given the similarity between all mammals, it's likely to work in mammals. Let's see. Kiroshima University researchers Masayuki Shimada and colleagues published this in the open access journal Public Library of Science Biology. And so here we go. The Y chromosome carries very, very few genes. Most of the genes, let's just say that the X chromosome carries a lot of genes. The Y chromosome has very few. So when you're a sperm and you're carrying an X chromosome, some of those genes in that X chromosome are actually active. About 500 of them, in fact. I had always thought they were just kind of coiled up into chromatin, but it turns out there's a few of those hairpins we talked about a month or so ago, and those are transcribing, and about 18 of them encoded for surface receptors, and a couple of these receptors were actually things that could be used to manipulate the sperm. So the researchers found a couple of toll-like receptors. These are receptors that exist to pick up bacterial lipopolysaccharides, but they're also used in inflammatory signaling. Anyway, they found a chemical that would bind to the receptors, and it worked by impairing the energy production by triggering the toll-like receptors. That slowed down the X chromosome sperm, so they were able to just let them swim across the petri dish, so to speak, and all of the male sperm, which hadn't had their energy affected, were now faster swimmers, so they got to the other side of the petri dish a lot faster. And you could literally just cut the gelatin apart when you thought that half the sperm had gotten across, and you'd end up with a dominant amount of Y chromosome sperm on one side of your petri dish. Well, you could also take the slow swimmer side, and they did both. So when they did in vitro fertilization with the faster swimmers, they got mouse litters that were, instead of 50% male, 90% male. And when they did with the female, they got an 81% female ratio. So this is by far the cheapest way to separate sperm. The good news is that you could simply wash the chemical off of the sperm afterwards, and they would revert to their normal motility and presumably normal functioning. And they could be implanted either in vitro or simply implant those sperm into the fallopian tubes and you're off to the races. Sex selection has always been a real key in agricultural products and factory farming. Obviously, if you're running a dairy farm, you'd like 80% female calves as opposed to 50% female calves. But it also, of course, could be put to darker uses. And alas, given the great wide world that we live in, it probably will be. Almost everyone in the audience is aware of the difference between celiac disease and other forms of autoimmune disease. The key with celiac disease is that it's triggered by gluten. There are actually people who don't have celiac disease, which is defined by a loss of height of the villi in the small intestine and by the presence of certain antibodies against types of gluten, such as gliadin and indomitium. However, taking the gluten-sensitive who don't have celiac aside and just focusing on celiac disease, this is a real problem in Northern Europe. This study took 6,600 children, and all of them were at increased risk for developing celiac because they had a sibling with celiac disease or a parent with celiac disease. I don't know if they ran their DNA. That wasn't in the method section. They were in Sweden, Finland, Germany, and the USA. And what they found was some useful stuff for those of you who have one child with celiac or a family history of same and are seeking to protect your child. The first one was breastfeeding didn't protect, and what you ate, what your mother ate while you were breastfeeding didn't make a big difference. What was key was the age of 2 to 3. And from the age of 2 to 3, even small amounts of gluten, 2 grams, the amount that might be found in one slice of white bread, was associated with a 75% increase, almost a doubling, of the development of celiac disease. Those who ate less than 2 grams had the normal risk of development. This is very challenging if you've got a child, a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old in daycare, but if you're lucky enough to be in control of what the child is exposed to, this could be very useful just to put them on a gluten-free diet during these early years, and then you probably would be able to loosen up at 5 and not have to stay on the sort of helicopter watch to be sure that they're not getting too much gluten. So when we talk about gluten, I have to stop for a moment and say, for safety, I really recommend that you only eat organic wheat. And that's because of the practice of hardening the crop, which occurs in almost all non-organic wheat. And what hardening is spraying the stuff with Roundup about a week before you harvest it. And if you believe Monsanto's literature, the Roundup is totally gone from the crop. It's destroyed by sunlight. There's not any residual Roundup in the wheat. That's what they say. I'm not sure I buy that. Certainly there is experimental evidence to the contrary. Either way, I think it's a ridiculous practice. It does earn money, though. And so because the dying wheat that's suddenly been hit with a toxin frantically produces as many seeds as possible, so it actually increases the grain yield by about 10%. Good for the farmer, not so good for the unfortunate person who eats this wheat. There is, I think, every possibility that the glyphosate itself could have a real effect, adverse effect on the gut permeability. and animal data to that effect. And I just don't feel like I want to wait around for definitive evidence in humans. Let's not let the Monsanto play the William Morris, cast doubt on the data. And why don't we just use the precautionary principle? And if you're going to eat wheat, don't eat too much of it. And please, please make it organic. Our next email comes from Renee in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Natural remedies for an overactive bladder. Dear Dr. Dawn, I'm a longtime listener from Wisconsin. I'm a healthy, active 45-year-old female who's not overweight. I take several medications, Lexapro, 75 milligrams for anxiety, oral birth control, 20 milligrams of Crestor, and 88 milligrams of Synthroid. I also take 200 milligrams of CoQ10, a multivitamin, and magnesium. For the past couple of years, I've had bladder leakage when I sneeze, cough, or laugh. I've had my primary care doctor check my muscle tone, and she thought things were normal. I've been doing daily Kegel exercises with little improvement, but I still need to wear a bladder incontinence pad to prevent accidents. My sister recently noticed how often I go to the bathroom, about every 60 to 90 minutes, and suggested I try an overactive bladder medication, but I'd rather not take any medication. Googling herbal supplements is overwhelming. Can you offer any advice? Well, let's see. You're 45 years old and on birth control, so that means that you're premenopausal. If you were postmenopausal, I would be suggesting a little vaginal DHEA, which can be very helpful for both the overactive bladder, and it's helpful for the stress incontinence when you sneeze or cough, so you get a double benefit. But since you're too young to try that, I would suggest that you actually do a couple of things. And since we're on gluten, I'll throw that one out first. And that's go off wheat and dairy for about 2 weeks. And I know you're in Wisconsin. I know it'll be hard, but you can do it for 2 weeks. Salmon, fish, salads, there's lots of rice spread. There's lots of other things you can do. But go off gluten and go off dairy for a couple of weeks and see what happens. And also, if you are drinking coffee, please stop and see. You might have to taper down on the coffee. But these are, what you're doing here is you're removing some of the more common bladder irritants. And that's always worth doing before you launch into adding things in. Now, I've had a lot of good results with using Uva Ursi. And I like that. And I also like a compound called D-mannose. D-mannose is a sugar, and it kind of coats the inside of your bladder. Drinking aloe vera juice is another way to get those glycosaminoglycans and coat the inside of the bladder. And bone broth is yet another way to get those things in there. And it may be that you have an irritated bladder, so that's a possibility, and your sister may be on to something. In terms of the Kegel exercises, you may need to get yourself some vaginal weights. And a lot of times I've had people who get a little better with Kegels, but when I give them the vaginal weights, which you can buy online very privately, they work much better. You can just Google vaginal weights for incontinence, and they're really very useful. They are not uncomfortable, and they give you a little resistance, so it really helps build up that muscle. We're going now to the first on-air at ksqd.org email. Yay! Go team! This is from Joe, and Joe writes, my brother-in-law was diagnosed by infectious disease doctor. He was in hospital with a 105 fever. He's been there once a year for the last 3 years with the same thing. The doctor did 3 cultures this time before he got the right answer. Can you tell me about this, please? And thanks, as always, for your knowledge. And actually, it's signed Roseanne, so I guess Roseanne's using Joe's phone, and that's okay with me. This is a tough one to answer because the name of the bacteria isn't here, and what was cultured to get the results isn't here either. So I'm going to have to plead a little bit of confusion here, Roseanne, because I'm not quite sure what the question is. And the first thing I would say about it is that the chance of getting the same infection three times running for 3 years in a person who is structurally normal in the area, and that if it's the bladder infection, structurally normal in the bladder, if it's a lung infection, structurally normal in the lung, that's really unlikely. Your brother needs to be checked for immune diseases. Certainly he should have an HIV test if he hasn't. Possibly he has some comorbidity, like chronic bronchitis, which causes extra mucus production, where the bacteria can hide and kind of hide in the mucus and infect it. Possibly we're looking at some other type of issue. And so we'll send you an email, and hopefully you'll be able to turn around and reply quickly, or you can just send a follow-up answering some of those questions. Where is the infection? Do you have a bacteria name? Has it always recurred in the same location? And how was it treated? Presumably antibiotics, but do you have any names? That'll help me a lot in answering the question. We'll go to our first phone caller, and that is Kathy in Santa Cruz.
Oh, my gosh. Oh. Should I turn the radio down?
Oh, yeah. Honey, yes, you need to turn the radio down. But that was okay, very Twilight Zone. It was cool.
Yes, it was.
I'm glad we didn't get, like, the Jimi Hendrix feedback, though. That would not be good. I get that in my car sometimes when my phone doesn't turn off properly, and it's awful. It's like ice pick in the ears. Okay, so what can I do for you?
Okay, so I called a couple weeks ago, but I called towards the end of the show, and we didn't really have time to talk.
Okay, refresh my memory.
My dad has, I shouldn't say my dad, but a person that I know has collagenous colitis.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
right.
I wanted to know if you have any recommendations, or if you've heard of it, if you know what causes it. It's just really, I tried to do some research, but I didn't really come up with much.
Right, I gotcha. Okay, well, first of all, let's deconstruct the term. You know, collagen it stains pink so it's a product, it's a gene product, and it's a structural protein. And collagenous colitis is a condition where you see inflammation, and it causes chronic diarrhea. It's a type of, they consider it an inflammatory bowel disease. And when you take a biopsy and you stain it, you see that it stains very heavily for collagen. And collagen is made by a cell that we find in the sublevel of skin and other places that's called, these are called fibroblasts. And when you, let's say you want to heal a wound. So when you cut to someone surgically, or when you cut yourself, in fact, the fibroblasts start patching the wound with collagen. And then they lay down kind of a grid of collagen. And that collagen, when it's laid down at a proper level, contracts, and that's how scars get narrower and narrower as they heal. And so that's how all wounds healed before we invented stitches, but stitches is faster. So we don't know exactly what triggers microscopic colitis, which is the collagenous colitis, is a type of this. It's considered to be an autoimmune disease. But it's really due to, in my opinion, problems with the microbiome and the absence of anti-inflammatory bacteria that should be there. So your father could benefit greatly from seeing a functional medicine doctor and being placed on a 5R protocol. And this involves maybe eliminating... I mentioned gluten and dairy too with the previous caller. There's about 8 or 9 foods you eliminate, and they're basically all the stuff that's become industrial and that we eat vast quantities of, because this is a reactive process. And it's not just that the food causes it; it's that once you become damaged, these foods aggravate it. And so, if you eliminate those foods, It's kind of like when there's a forest fire and the wind comes up. If you could stop the wind, you'd have a better chance fighting the fire. So you can think of this food as extra wind. Then you've also got to try and get the microbiome healthier. And sometimes I will just do that empirically. We use either antibiotics, or I prefer plant-based antimicrobials, and I'll do different things, rosemary, thyme, pau d'arco, other plant tannins. And essentially what you're, and then I'll have the person eat lots of root vegetables and varied ones. So not just potatoes, not just sweet potatoes, but a variation on those things. And what we're trying to do is encourage the growth of the good guys, which among other things, reduce inflammation and tend to, block the further autoimmune inflammatory bowel disease. So the person's bowel starts working again, then they start reabsorbing the water like they're supposed to do. When the cells aren't sick, they do it. They do their job. When they're sick, they're just hanging on there, trying to, you know, panting and lying on the floor. So they aren't able to go answer the door or take out the garbage. And that's what we're trying to get your cells back to, is normal functioning. So it's a lot of things all done at once, with the idea that you're trying to move the gut back to a healthier state. And that's the functional medicine approach here. So you could, does he live locally? Is he, where does he live?
No, he doesn't.
Yeah. Where does he?
He lives partly in Germany, and that's where he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we communicate through email. And sometimes we talk on the phone, but,
when does he come to visit you?
It varies. Sometimes he comes like around Christmas time. Sometimes he comes, different times.
All right. So the next time that you know he's making a visit, you could reach out to, if you're local, you could reach out to me. If you're elsewhere, you could reach out to, functionalmedicine.org, and they have a find a doctor, and you just put in your zip code, and that will find you a list of certified functional medicine. Be sure to click the certified button. And these are people who have literally taken a board exam in this stuff, and they know how to do it. And he could be set up with a program that he could take back to Germany with him and do remotely. Because a lot of this is just changing your behavior. And I mean, the Germans, they love their root vegetables, so it's not good. And, you know, fortunately, they have less GMO food in the EU. So if you tell him that he has to have, that he needs to eat vegetable, that he needs to eat root vegetables smothered in butter every day, you know, I don't think he'll feel bad.
Well, another thing is he takes hydrocodone for pain. And I wonder if that's part of what caused it.
I'm having a hard time feeling like the hydrocodone was causal here. Okay. I'd be much more inclined to suspect antibiotics that he might have gotten for an infection in the year before he had his first episode. Sometimes this will happen after, if you travel up, like if you go to some exotic place, maybe go to safari in Africa, you know, and you get some parasite. The parasite can sort of start the inflammation, kind of like lighting a match. Sometimes people will get, we know that certain bacteria will flare. If you have like rheumatic arthritis and you get, let's see, which bacteria is it does that? I know it's Klebsiella and Reuter's syndrome, but I'm blanking on which bacteria it is that will trigger a flare of rheumatoid arthritis. But we really do think that, I was mentioning earlier in the first segment, the very first segment of the program, these toll-like receptors, they're pro-inflammatory, many of them. And so, and bacteria fragments, if they can get, if the parasite cuts a hole in the bowel, just a little hole to suck blood through, those fragments of dead bacteria get across there, and that stimulates the immune system, and that sets you up for a whole problem. So I think that might be, we don't really have to know what started the fire to know how to put out the fire, right? And that's how we think of it.
Yeah, okay. But I just kind of wonder, like, if he continues thinking it, and even if he's trying to, he's taking all the, you know, eating the root vegetables and getting his microbiome back to what it should be, but he continues to take the thing that's, like, causing it.
I really think that, there is reasons to be worried about someone who takes hydrocodone every day, but I do not. I think it's a false association for just because they're happening in the same person to think that one is causing the other. I mean, we don't see that. We've got an epidemic of people taking hydrocodone all over the place in this country, and we are not seeing we're not seeing this great flare of collagenous colitis. So I don't think there's much evidence to support the idea. I think it's just, I think it's just creeping you out, and I don't blame you. It's scary to think that he might get addicted to this stuff, especially it's on the news every 5 minutes, and, you know, this is your dad, so naturally you're concerned.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. I'll just encourage him to do the microbiome.
I think he needs guidance,
repair.
You know. I think he needs guidance. You're probably going to need to get him hooked up with someone who can hand him a program. Is he kind of this sort of orderly, check all the boxes kind of guy?
I don't.
Okay, not so much. Okay,
so,
too bad, because they make the best patients when you give them a program. They're like, they yavol, and off they go and do the program. Those people are a joy to work with. You don't have to ride them quite so hard. But in any event, there is hope, and the elimination diet piece, that's something that I'd be willing to just send you if you emailed me at askdrdawn.com and just use the box there. I'll send you the complete elimination diet that gives you the list of foods to avoid. And the thing is, if he goes on that after 3 weeks, his symptoms are better, then you know you're on the right track in terms of being able to get somewhere. And maybe that buys him a little bit more credibility and willingness to go the extra mile on the other stuff, which involves swallowing a lot of capsules.
I think it'll be hard for him to really do a lot, very much of it, but we'll see. You never know.
Well, there's no magic. There's plenty of magic pills. The problem is, A, they're expensive, and B, they have toxic side effects. So
I know, yeah. And he did take something, you know, the doctor prescribed like cortisone, I think. Mm-hmm. I think it was cortisone that he just prescribed.
Sure.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Cortisone will work, but if you take cortisone for a long time, there's all sorts of negative side effects, from everything from diabetes to osteoporosis, all the bad stuff. So,
I don't think he took it, and then it didn't help, so he stopped taking it, which I was glad. Mm. But I was wondering, like, since it's so, like, he's losing so much water, how come he doesn't get dehydrated and, like, eventually just, you know, die from dehydration?
Well, people do die from dehydration. They call it cholera.
Right.
And but generally loose stools don't necessarily, he's going to be able to compensate. His thirst mechanism will cause him to drink more fluid. The thing is, when we talk about the dehydration issue, if I'm drinking and I'm not taking all the water back out of my poop, so my poop is like applesauce, then that's about like one applesauce poop. I'm down maybe 8 ounces of water. So what happens is my kidneys will compensate by making my urine more concentrated. And so there's a fair amount of and my brain will compensate by making me drink an extra glass of water. And so our bodies are pretty good except when something gets really out of whack. So he could have three, even four loose stools a day and not get dehydrated, because he will compensate for it.
Okay. Got it. All right, I see.
All righty. Well, good luck to you,
okay,
and thanks
well,
for
thank
calling
you
back.
Thank you so much.
You're
yes,
very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, I promised you the 3D blastocyst-like embryonic structure generated from mouse stem cells. Now, this is a deep science dive, and can't do an Ask Dr. Dawn episode without at least one of these. So this is an international collaboration between United States and Germany, and what they had just published in Stem Cell Reports shows that if you take stem cells and you incubate them, let me just read through this, okay? After an egg is fertilized, it begins to divide and passes through several stages. And the two cell stages are capable of becoming any type of cell. That's when you get identical twins. If the cell splits at that point, then you're going to get two complete human beings because you have two totally pluripotent cells. After a few more cell divisions, you get a ball of cells. And this ball has a top, bottom, and a middle. And at this point, if you take a cell off, it's not going to be able to turn into a complete being. This blastocyst is like a hollow ball. The cells on the outside are now committed, but the cells on the inside are not. And so researchers for several years, we can actually thank the religious right for this in this country, because when they limited the use of embryonic stem cells, researchers had to figure out how to take skin cells and get them to convert back into stem cells. But no one's been able to get all the way back to the totipotent cells, to that two-cell stage. The researchers were able to do this by taking pluripotent mouse cells, that is to say, these are later stem cells, and they brought them back into a pre-implanted state. Basically, they've been able to reprogram pluripotent mouse stem cells into totipotent. That means you can get a whole mouse out of one of those cells, not just a mouse heart. What they found was that the cells spontaneously formed into blastocysts, and they were very, very similar to what an actual early mouse embryo looks like, and also very, very similar in function. So the process takes the, let's say, cells that are committed and turns them into uncommitted cells, and you end up with about 30 to 50 embryos that look like they're going to turn into complete mice if you do that. And if you open them up, you find the two-cell embryos. Now the question is, what if we took those and implanted them into mouse uteruses, would we be able to get early, would we be able to actually get embryos? And they haven't gone that far, but what they have done is take these fake blastocysts that are coming from deprogrammed skin cells in the mice and implant them in the uterus and make a placenta. So these blastocysts are capable of saying, oh, wait, I'm in the uterus. It's time to make a placenta and start growing. And this is the first step towards what we're already doing, cloning, right? But this is a completely different kind of cloning. You never actually have to get to the point of maturity. And it provides us with the possibility of a totally programmable cell. So it can, if one cell can form a placenta and a body, well, then we can also tell it to form just about anything. What this teaches us is that, well, like they say in real estate, location, location, location. It's not until you implant the blastocyst, take it out of cell culture, and put it in a uterus where it gets the signals that it needs to keep differentiating and turn into a placenta with an embryo. And the fact that that happens more or less spontaneously, if you can just get the right cell into the right location, is fascinating. Now, I don't think that's going to work in mature animals, maybe in mature uteruses, but the uterus is a very, well, special organ, and one that we all need to give a lot of respect to. So I'm going to take a deep breath and just honor the uterus, both the uterus that I came from and the uteri that all of my friends came from. Let's talk about a walking robot. I think we will see this very soon. So researchers at Columbia Engineering have made a robotic device that basically provides light touch assistance in walking to the aged people and others with impaired mobility. They basically built an autonomous robot that quote-unquote walks, I presume it rolls, alongside a person and holds out an arm, but it's not a rigid arm. It's like if you're walking with your grandmother and you hold out your elbow so she can rest her hand on your elbow for balance. It turns out that that this robotic arm is capable of providing a very wonderful dynamic assistance to people. So they used it to analyze the effects of this cane. They're calling it canine, C-A-N-I-N-E, and it's a cane-like mobile assistance. It helps the person know where they are in space during walking, improves their stability and balance. And they actually did a study with young people where they gave them virtual reality glasses that gave them a shaking visual environment, both up and down and sideways and forward and backwards, to screw up their walking. And then they walked them around on a sensor mat with and without the robotic cane. And they found that the light touch support of just that little arm on the side made a huge difference. If you want to test this out for yourself, I want you to experience this. So if you've got a corner in your house where it's safe to do it, stand with your right foot forward and your left foot back and your left toe touching your right heel, so the feet are in a line, and keep your eyes open, but be in a corner where you can grab the walls and see how long you can stand like that with your eyes open. It's a little hard, you're a little wobbly, but you'd probably be able to do it for, you know, at least 15, 20 seconds. Then close your eyes. And without the visual assistance, you'll start wobbling like crazy. Everybody does. This is a great way if your balance is slightly impaired or you're feeling like it's deteriorating. This is a great physical therapy exercise to improve your balance, by the way. Anyway, once you touch the wall, boom, you're fine. You straighten up. You're no longer disoriented. And that's what this robotic arm does. I can see this being really invaluable. It's much better than a walker or other forms of devices that people use for balance. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long. And stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.